Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 26th of April. Last week, we had James Fallows on the air, always a very well-spoken and interesting interview, and he mentioned a book he had written in The Atlantic, If You Were Depressed by the Devastating Takedowns of Greg Mortensen's Three Cups of Tea. Then you ought to be able to find inspiration from Rye Barcott and his new book, It Happened on the Way to War, A Marine's Path to Peace, which he says a verified story, unlike Mortensen's, is in its own way at least as inspiring as what we had understood Mortensen's to be. It's actually in a incredibly remarkable story of what a very, very young man was able to do in terms of trying to alleviate poverty, and it also incorporates his service as a Marine. The book is It Happened on the Way to War, A Marine's Path to Peace, and it has just been published to coincide with the 10th anniversary of an organization that he helped to found in Kenya. And it is also the release of Chasing the Mad Lion, a feature-length documentary about the organization. It's a story of community, culture, pride, and making a difference. And in Rye's words, it's my great hope that this story will help inspire and inform a new cadre of social entrepreneurs committed to taking on our most challenging problems collaboratively and with the understanding that talent is universal, but opportunity is not. Rye co-founded Carolina for Kibera when he was an undergraduate at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. He served for 5 years in the Marines, and he has earned master's degrees in business and public administration from Harvard. He is working in the sustainability office at Duke Energy and was named in 2006 by ABC World News. He was then Captain Barcott, a person of the year for his dual service to Kibera and also the Marine Corps. We'll be welcoming phone calls for him. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email address is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Hi, Rye.
Hi, it's great to be here.
Yeah, wonderful to have you here. Did you know that James Fallows is saying wonderful things about you?
Well, I didn't know that until I just heard it on the phone, and I'm going to have to send him a note of thanks. He is a writer that I and, of course, so many others admire tremendously.
Well, he admires you, too, as well. So he brought you to our attention, and we're happy to have you on the air. Your story is just incredible, and I think we have to start with your childhood, because you've got these parents who are professors who were different kinds of people. Your dad served in Vietnam. Your mom's an anthropologist. You've got peace and war kind of flowing through your veins when you're a pretty young kid.
Yeah, that's right. And I mean, and that's really the heart and soul of this book, is about the merging of these two forms of service, of military service, which was really my first calling, in part because of my father's experience having served in the Marines. He was not a career Marine, but many of his closest friends became mentors to me at a very early age. And so when I was a young teenager, I sort of set out to follow his footsteps in a way, but also hopefully serve something that was larger than myself, and the Marine Corps offered challenge and adventure and all these sorts of things. And Kibera, this community in Nairobi, Kenya, really did in many ways happen on the way to war, so to speak, because I went to Kenya in part really to understand why ethnic violence occurred. I assumed that this was before September 11th, so I assumed that the missions I'd be on as a Marine would be of a peacekeeping type of nature, interventions during ethnic strife. And my mother is an anthropologist, and she actually named me, gave me the middle name Mead.
Margaret.
Yeah, after Margaret Mead, and one of her favorite quotes is one of Margaret Mead's most famous quotes. we were at the Gates Foundation last week doing a presentation, and it's the quote is now emblazoned up on the wall of the new Gates Foundation building, and it's that, you know, never doubt the power of a small group of committed, thoughtful citizens to change the world, because it's the only thing that ever has. And that saying, you know, change the world has a lot of cliche to it, and I certainly wasn't. I didn't go to Kibera to start an organization 11 years ago. I was an undergraduate and knew I was going in the military. Wanted to be better prepared for my service in the Marines. But what I found was that I fell into relationships in part because my mother had really encouraged me to spend time in the community, to take some of the local, to learn some of the local language before I traveled there. So I spoke Swahili to immerse myself into the community. And so I had rented a shack with a fellow who was about my age, a 10x10, they called it, a 10x10-foot shack in this slum community that's very vast, somewhere between 200,000 to 500,000 people live there. And what I found was that although in those early days I had a really natural reaction to the place, which was to be overwhelmed by the conditions, by the squalor, really, and the deprivation, that was an initial reaction. And what I realized very quickly was that fundamental truth that's really the dedication of the book, and that's that talent is universal, but opportunity's not.
Mm-hmm.
And I was seeing that because I was forming relationships with young people who were about my age and extraordinarily gifted, yet trapped in an environment with very few opportunities. And I was impressed by them. I was also somewhat distraught when I started looking at other organizations, non-governmental organizations that existed in and around this slum community in Nairobi, and so many of these organizations were not locally led, and were not really getting resources to the ground into the community because they were directed by outsiders. Yet I was meeting these really compelling people who had the skills to solve some of the problems that they faced and their community faced. And that for me really led to a recognition of something that I believe is really important, and that is that change has to happen from within communities.
Right.
It can't be imposed on the outside. Mm-hmm. And that with that sort of understanding, a couple Kenyans and I co-founded an organization called it Carolina for Kibera. And really started off by trying to invest directly into young leaders in a holistic way in this slum community. And we started off using sports, primarily soccer, to bring different ethnic groups together and build leaders from within. And that was about 10 years ago. And so the organization continues to this day. There are about 50,000 members of the community.
50,000. Oh, that! And here it is, 10 years after you founded it. That must make you feel wonderful.
It does. I you know, it was interesting. We're doing this. We're on a 26-city book tour and outreach campaign with a large focus in high schools and colleges, because that's really the audience that I principally wrote the book for. And we were out at Google about 2 weeks ago, and somebody asked me if we were motivated by guilt. And I found it to be a really interesting question because I think that it is sort of a natural reaction when you first get exposed, when you first see conditions of extreme poverty for the initial time. It's jarring. And maybe there is a sense of guilt, but guilt's not sustainable.
Hmm.
What is sustainable is the daily inspiration that you can get by seeing a small amount of resources going into the hands of people who are able to transform not only their own lives, but also the lives of their community. And I think a great example of that is really one of the heroes of the book and a co-founder of this organization, Tabitha Besto.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I met Tabitha because she was staying near me that summer when I was renting a small shack in Kibera. And she confronted me. She said, "You know, you're asking all of these kids about their problems. Lakini mimi na kuwa na shida kubwa pia. I got big problems too, and you've never asked me about my life. So sit down, and I'm going to tell you a little bit about my life." And I sat down, and Tabitha told me a bit about her background. She was widowed with three kids, and she had formerly been a nurse before she lost her job when the government cut down on its health care expenditures. And she'd been unemployed for 2 years almost. And towards the end of that conversation, she proposed a solution. She said, "Give me 2,000 shillings, which is about $26.
Mm-hmm.
Not much.
No.
But I had made a habit of not giving out any money in Kibera, in part for my own security, in
right.
part because I didn't know where to begin. I mean, even amounts of money that small can also, if not handled in the right way, can actually cause greater problems than they sometimes can help solve. And so I asked Tabitha what she was planning on doing with it, and she said, "Well, I'm going to sell vegetables. I'm going to buy vegetables here in Kibera and sell them in another community where she could undercut the competition." And, you know, there was something about the conviction in her voice, and she had a plan. And in the end, what the heck, it was just $26. And so I handed her the money, and I didn't think I'd see her again. I actually left a couple days later. I returned to the United States and started Officer Canada School.
I can't believe you had both of these heavy-duty things going on at the same time. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, my mom, and I didn't do well at Officer Candidate School, maybe in part because of the jarring contrast, but for the first time in my life, I finished at the bottom of the class, and I was so embarrassed by that performance that I asked my parents not to come to graduation, and they obliged. You know, they didn't come to the graduation, but I called my mom afterwards, and she warned me. She warned me of what she called dual culture shock, which was the experience of these two worlds. And she said, "You know, it's going to take some time," and it did take some time. And I spent the final. I had one more year left at college, so I spent my senior year in college and continued this dialogue with some of the young people I had met in Kibera. And we decided to start an organization together, and we called it Carolina for Kibera, and we were going to fundamentally focus on using soccer to bring different ethnic groups together and help young leaders grow from within. And I didn't think I'd see Tabitha again when I returned that next summer. The Marine Corps gave me leave for about 3 months to do this, in part because this was before September 11th, and we had too many lieutenants. So they said, "Sure, if you've got a plan and you've pulled this together, you can take 3 months of unpaid leave." And so I returned to start this sports program, and we started it. But not, you know, it wasn't too long after that Tabitha found me, and she took my hand, and we went zigzagging up the alleyways, and she took me back to her 10-by-10-foot shack, which she had converted into a small medical clinic.
Isn't that remarkable? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And she, you know, on the side of the wall of this clinic, it read, "Rye Medical Clinic." And I thought, and I looked at it, and I felt, you know, flabbergasted in some respects, but also, you know, more than a little self-conscious, because what in the end had I done? I mean, I was a bumbling college student, and I met this remarkable person who had some of the solutions to the problems that she and her community faced, and who should have been able to access something as mere as $26 in another way,
mm-hmm.
but who wasn't able to do that. And so Tabitha joined our team, joined our organization, Carolina for Kibera, and healthcare delivery from within became a part of this organization, and And today that clinic, which is no longer the Rye Clinic, it is the Tabitha Clinic, that clinic treats over 40,000 patients a year.
Oh, Rye. You know, one of the things that was striking to me about reading your immersion in that culture is I was thinking very few people, maybe I hope more than I would think, but very few people would immerse themselves as totally as you did without feeling, oh, this is dirty, I'm going to get sick. You subjected yourself, and you did get sick, but you were just there. You were experiencing everything that was going on, an area that people had deemed extremely dangerous. And maybe it was your mom or your parents who allowed you to do that, but you couldn't do what you've done unless you walked in and became really a member of the family.
It was so important, but I also found that there were just so many stereotypes that abounded about places like Kibera. You know, this is a large slum community, and the conditions are striking, but they're not unusual in the world. You know, by some estimates, up to a sixth of the world's population will live in urban informal settlements like Kibera by 2020. And what I found was that in these communities, a large portion of the community are young people and kids. You know, in Kibera, almost half the population's under the age of 15. And there's a vibrancy to the community and a resilience. And so I was really welcomed by the residents. And that's not to say that there wasn't danger. Sometimes there was danger, particularly at night. The slum becomes a very different place between the daytime and the nighttime. We have undergraduate volunteers who go over with our organization each year. We've never had one incident where their security's been in jeopardy during the daytime. Mm-hmm. But things shift at night, and I think looking back at that, My parents, of course, played a huge role in shaping my values. But the military did as well, and I applied some of the principles that I was being exposed to through the ROTC program at the time, and later as I went on and continued to serve in the Marines, I applied some of those basic principles of risk-taking, but also kind of pushing boundaries, you know, just because
yes.
a place is perceived to be a certain way doesn't mean that it necessarily is. And to really understand any community, you have to be in it. You have to be talking to people and exposing yourself as well.
What did you learn? And we also need to add that you were you were a great student during all this time as well. You were reading books that were looking at ethnic violence in with very profound titles. You were meeting with people who had studied this. You were immersing yourself not only in being there, but in also in learning all that you could. And so before we go to phone calls, I wanted to ask when your initial question, why ethnic violence occurred and what could take its place, what you could build that would lessen that violence. How did you answer the question after all of your research and after living this? Why did ethnic violence occur?
Yes. I mean, there was one of the books that really affected me tremendously was Philip Gurevich's book on Rwanda. We wish to inform you that tomorrow we'll be killed with our families.
Ugh.
And Gurevich, he takes readers into this question of why do these events happen? And at a certain point, they're still inexplicable. At a certain point, they're inexplicable. But one thing is for sure, and that is that ethnic violence is very rarely simply rooted in deep-seated, impermeable hatreds. Most often, almost all the time, I think, it is motivated by political and economic factors, and poor leadership, and that there are things that can be done to prevent it, and that it's really it's always a complex mixture of components that lead to the outbreak of extreme violence, but that it is preventable, it's stoppable, especially if folks are able to form long-term, enduring relationships across ethnic lines, and frankly, that in places that have enlightened leadership. And so that's really our hope in Kibera. That's why we invest so much of our lives, mostly as volunteers, over the last 10 years. It's to invest in the leaders of tomorrow, because they're the ones that are going to be able to break the violence in places like Kibera, or even places where we find our military these days, Afghanistan, Iraq. I mean, most of the revolutions across Africa and the Middle East right now are being driven by youth. And some folks have written about the prevalence of a youth bulge. That is, when you look at the demographics and upwards of 40-50% of populations being under the age of 15, that's going to be a defining element in our world security, both our own as well as our global security. So, that was one of the ways that Kibera really informed my experience in the Marines. And what I've tried to do in this book is show both how they clashed, those two worlds clashed as well as converged, as I experienced them over an 8-year period of time.
We welcome phone calls for you, Ryan. We'll take them momentarily. Rye Barcott is our guest. His book is It Happened on the Way to War, A Marine's Path to Peace. He co-founded the Carolina for Kibera when he was an undergraduate at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. He also served for 5 years in the Marines. The organization that he founded, as you heard him describe, is still flourishing 10 years later, with a huge clinic that serves so many people in this very, very poor, devastatingly poor part of Kenya. And also the Identifying Youth Leaders program continues in full force as well, which is, kudos to him for doing this and seeing that it could happen and carrying through on it. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to your phone calls at 800-486-8655. Gina Wauwatosa, hi.
Hi, good morning. Thank you again for a fabulous show, Kathleen. I guess I'd say huge kudos to your parents. And I wanted to share a quick anecdote, if I could. My sister is involved, created a group in Sydney using soccer also to help a large refugee population of teenagers and young adults, refugees from with awful experiences in their lives. And as they moved to Australia, she was trying to figure a way to help this population. And she was in the Solomon Islands looking out and all of a sudden thought, soccer, that's it. And her group has flourished as well. They were able to go to Johannesburg for the FIFA held a second World Cup for groups last summer. So I just wanted to share that. And thank your guests for being a wonderful American citizen ambassador and also a microfinancer.
Yeah, thank you, Gina. I appreciate that. And what it reminds me, I mean, soccer really is a universal language in some respects, and it's simple. It doesn't take much resources to organize. But I think the important thing for me, and this was not a conclusion that I came to, it was really a lesson that I learned from one of my co-founders, Salim Mohammed. The important lesson is that it's not about soccer. It's about using soccer as a tool to help young leaders grow, to break cycles of violence and poverty from within communities. And a good example of this with our organization is that in order to play soccer, you have to participate in community service cleanups. And these are something we call Vita Vya Taka Taka, which is Swahili for wars on garbage.
Oh.
And they are some of the most physically exhaustive things I've ever done, including in the Marines. Some of the physical activity couldn't compare to these, because we literally would go into the community and clean the sumps of sewage and waste and spend hours doing it. And the community doesn't necessarily stay clean, but that's not the point. Point is building an ethos of giving back and doing it from within this organization. So thank you, Gene. I applaud your sister for her work in Sydney.
That's great. Thank you so much, Gene, for the call. Let's talk a little bit more, because some people will find these two cultures, it's hard to figure out how you can do both. It's still hard for me to figure out how you did both. But this, you have said, what unites the warrior and the peacekeeper is primal ego, pure and simple. Can you talk a little bit more about that, and also about this trying to cross both worlds? I still don't know how you did it.
Yeah,
right?
I mean, and I wrestled with it at times, and I tried to keep mental compartments between the two worlds and keep them separated, and sometimes that worked, but oftentimes they clashed and converged, because our lives, of course, are integrated. And I think one of the keys for me was that the military, in my opinion, serves a very important role in society. And even though militaries have been misused, including our own. My father is a Vietnam veteran and has severe misgivings about how we waged that particular war. Even though they've been misused, they serve a fundamental role, and that is to provide a common defense and to preserve peace fundamentally. And so, while I had and still have deep concerns about why we went into the Iraq War in particular. And by the time I served in Fallujah, it was 2005, 2006, the entire premise of that war had been revealed to be false. That mattered, but it still was important to have talented, committed American men and women on our front lines to try and end that war as responsibly and as quickly as possible, and with the least amount of damage to both American as well as Iraqi civilian life. And that was a mission that mattered, and one that I was willing to be a part of, a small part of.
Willing to die for as well, or did you struggle with that?
Well, I think we all struggle with it if we're honest. And there is a sense of invincibility that can, in my case, and I think for many veterans, becomes shattered very quickly when you confront the harsh realities of violence. And what I've tried to do in this book is really give an honest and accurate depiction of the effects of violence on the human spirit, and both the strengths as well as the severe limitations at times of the use of military force.
Mm-hmm. Where were you, going back to Tabitha for a moment, when you got the call from her saying you need to come back to Kenya? You need to see me.
This was in 2004. I was based in Djibouti on a small mission that we still have to this day, a counterterrorism mission in the Horn of Africa and in parts of Yemen. And Tabitha had called me. I did try and keep these mental compartments between the two worlds, and my focus was always on my career and my Marines and because that military service, particularly overseas, it's all consuming, and it's pure. And what I found was that Kibera, the reason why we were able to continue our work in Kibera, why I was able to continue the work in Kibera, was because I wasn't doing it. I wasn't leading it. I'm not calling the shots on the ground. It was led by Tabitha, by Salim, by our committed team of Kenyans who know the community because they've lived in it. And what I found, though, was that Kibera offered a respite for me. It offered an escape in a way, a way to pick up a satellite phone after a long patrol and connect with a community that that I care deeply about, and with friends who I knew and trusted, despite our differences in nationality and ethnicity, sometimes in religion, there was a common that set of values that transcended those differences.
Mm-hmm. And so she asked you to come back, and she was sick.
Yes, Tabitha was sick at the time, and I had never had a moment up until that point. I was a first lieutenant at the time in the Marines. I had never had a moment where these two duties, in a way, conflicted with each other. But Tabitha needed to see me, and so I went to my Marine commander, a gruff old salt colonel, and I asked him. I poured it all out. I told him about our work. We had not talked about it before. I told him about our work in Kibera, and
mm-hmm.
I just put it all out there and asked him for some permission to take a few days and travel down to Nairobi, which was a few hundred miles south of the base in Djibouti. And he looked at me and he said, "You know, Lieutenant, what you're doing there in Kibera is God's work," he said. And I had never thought about it in such terms. But that didn't matter in many regards. And the colonel gave me permission to head back to see Tabitha and to be with our team during a very important moment, about 3 years into the organization's life. And so, well, that's what I found, really, was that, and I didn't talk a lot about Kibera when I was in the Marines. In fact, many of the veterans who I'm now meeting on our tour, as we go around the country, and we'll be in Minneapolis next week on Tuesday and Wednesday. Many of the veterans that I'm meeting at these events are really taken by the work in Kibera. They see it as a way to prevent the outbreak of violence, or to help prevent the outbreak mm-hmm. of violence, mm-hmm. instead of the very costly in terms of money as well as human life resources that get expended when a situation descends into the vortex of war.
Yeah, let's go to Jed in Duluth. Hi, Jed.
Hello.
Yes, go right ahead, Jed.
Yes, all non-governmental organizations, NGOs, are well-intended, but not all are helpful. I'd be interested in your inputs on what is a sustainable help. I recently came back from Kabul, Afghanistan, where the hospitals were pretty primitive, but the Afghan military hospital was quite good because of intervention by our own U.S. military, and I would see that as a sustainable benefit. Can you comment?
Thanks, Jed. And that was part of my real frustration when I initially traveled to Kibera as a college student 11 years ago, this slum in Nairobi. And I was seeing non-governmental organizations that were severely handicapped. And the reason why many of the ones that I had come across were less than effective was because they weren't locally led. And so what we talk about at Carolina for Kibera is a concept, we call it participatory development. And participatory development basically means that the change has to come from within the community. And the way to do that is to form long-term, enduring relationships with local leaders who themselves have some of the solutions to the problems that they face. And, of course, that's easier said than done, particularly in our short-term oriented world, where increasingly bombarded with information and relationships can become, particularly with communities that are outside of our immediate families, maintaining those relationships can be difficult. But it takes work, and through that effort, I think you can see a tremendous impact that you can be a part of. I think that when I think about sustainability, I think it's got to start there. Sustainability has to start with local leadership.
Hmm. Thank you so much, Jed, for your call. Yeah, I read your story and listen to you, and I wonder, how in the world did you get to be so old when you were so young? I mean, you were so wise and committed, and what about what most 20-year-olds are doing. They're going to school, but they're falling in love. They're breaking up. They're falling in love again. They're breaking up and falling in love. They're going to parties. And here you are reading these profound works and living in this area in Kenya and starting an NGO that's effective. It's fairly remarkable, isn't it?
Well, I was going to some parties too, at Chapel Hill and on Franklin Street, and enjoying the college life as well. But I think I really look back to some of the values that my mother instilled in me with just being teaching me how to be a good listener, and I was fortunate to have tremendous mentors who took time to really expose me to their wisdom. And I write about some of them. Of course, first and foremost are my parents, but also just some of the professors that I met at UNC who took time to really give of themselves. An anthropologist named James Peacock, a military historian named Richard Cohn. It was through them that I began to really be exposed to a larger world, and frankly, also the resources of the university. There was a fellowship that I applied for that gave me the means to travel to Kenya. So I feel very grateful to have been exposed to some remarkable people, and to go to a place, Kibera, that really made me confront this fundamental truth. That's the dedication of the book, that the talent's universal,
yes,
but opportunity's not. Mm-hmm. And that was profound for me, that realization. And I hope that this book can help both inspire and inform other young doers, folks that are in college, and that you might be partying. That's fine. You can still be a doer and still be going to parties and still be dating and all of this. The key is the approach. And the approach is recognizing that nobody does it alone. And that real change begins with deep relationships, and some of those relationships might be with people that are very different from your immediate peer group. Mm. So that's one of the core goals for me, really, hopefully with this book, is that it will reach folks who are thinking about the impact that they can make in the communities that they care about.
You have a child now, don't you?
Yes, we do. Our baby daughter is with her for Easter, and she is almost 1 year old.
Oh. And I'm wondering how you must have given very deep thought to how you'll be raising her as well, haven't you?
I have, and I must say as well that, when I look back at my military service, I was single. I was dating my then wife, my now wife, but I was single, and I didn't have a family, and I didn't have a real appreciation for the Marines that were serving in my command who had kids and who were go away from them for periods of time, 6 to 12 months. It's really tough, and that service too, the spouses, the significant others, the parents, the service goes around and is widespread. So I look back. I, now being a father, I have a far greater appreciation for the parents out there.
And tell me about the kind of work that you're doing now, Rye.
Yes. So I'm on book tour and an outreach campaign to colleges and universities for the next 3 months.
Uh-huh.
And then, but I'm able to do that because I work for a company that's given me sabbatical, and that company is Duke Energy. I started working for this company about 8 months ago, and focused on our sustainability efforts and the transition to a, Duke Energy has a big challenge, and that is that we need to transition to a lower carbon future, and the company is a big burner of coal and natural gas. It emits a lot of carbon dioxide in the world, but our CEO is Jim Rogers come out and is very concerned about what I really believe is one of the defining issues of my generation, and that is climate change. And so I'm trying to be an agent of change from within one of our companies that serves many millions of Americans and American businesses.
Hmm. We're going to welcome more phone calls. If you'd like to join our conversation, please do. Our guest is Rye Barcott, who, as you can tell from listening to him, has a whole lot to him and has so many stories to tell. It Happened on the Way to War, A Marine's Path to Peace is the name of this book, and he's jammed so much into his life, probably the story that he hopes will inspire the young people he's speaking to on this tour is the story of Carolina for Kibera, which is an NGO that is identifying leaders and is being run because of leadership and talent found within this community that Rye lived in and helped discover some of the talent when he was there some 10 years ago. He also was a Marine, and so it looks at the life of a warrior and the places where those two paths may cross and where they may be in conflict as well. And it's an inspirational story, of service, and he continues that in his life now. So join our conversation if you'd like. If you just want to listen, that's fine as well. I know some of you have worked with NGOs, and he firmly believes that you need to have them flourish because of what happens within the community, that too often the structure is imposed outside the community, and as a result, they may not be very effective. 800-486-8655 is our number, 800-486-8655. Or the email, if you'd like to send that, is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Rye Barcott, our guest. The book is It Happened on the Way to War, A Marine's Path to Peace. Cody is next from Oshkosh. Hi, Cody.
Hi there. My wife's an RN, and we're both looking to retire early and would love to get involved with a group like this. How's the best way to do that?
Sure. Thanks, Cody, and congrats on your upcoming retirement. Tabitha, of course, was a nurse, and we have a large cadre of Kenyan nurses and two Kenyan medical doctors at our clinic. I think there are a lot of organizations that are doing important work on the ground, locally embedded into communities like ours, and to volunteer, especially as a medical practitioner, can be awfully helpful. My main piece of advice is when you're out there searching for organizations, if you and your wife can dedicate a significant amount of time, more than 2 months, to going to a place and giving back, that is really the most helpful for organizations like ours. It's far more difficult to coordinate volunteers who stay for short periods of time, a couple weeks here, a couple weeks there. It's also more valuable, I think, for what you'd find is for your own experience, because foreign cultures are, of course, complex places, and it takes some time to really begin to develop an understanding of the communities as well. So I wish you all the best, and please also, if Carolina for Kibera might be of interest in particular, check us out, and we'd love to be in touch.
Thank you.
Thanks, Cody, for the call. And you can do you want to give us a website, or you can just Google that?
Oh, yes. It's just carolinaforkibera.org.
Okay, great. When you speak, you're on this tour now speaking to high school and college students, your primary demo here. What do you hope will happen? What do you want from them?
Yeah, and we will be in Minnesota next week. Put another plug in for that on Tuesday and Wednesday. And I know this is Wisconsin Public Radio, but if there are any listeners who will
there
be
are
in Minneapolis,
listeners, yes, there are listeners in Minnesota. Uh huh.
Terrific. Well, we'll be speaking to some students there. And the key message, and what I've really hoped that I've been able to show without telling in the book, is a takeaway that you don't have to wait to make an impact. You don't have to wait for wealth or status.
Or to grow up, right.
Yeah, or age or privilege. You know, any of these. You don't have to wait. You can do it, and you can do it now, especially if you take the right approach. And we believe that's a participatory approach. We believe that is fundamentally about exposing yourself to new places, and being willing to listen. You know, be a doer, but in order to be an effective doer, you gotta listen first, and you've gotta expose yourself to others and really build meaningful relationships. And if you do that, never, as Margaret Mead said, never doubt the power of a small group of committed citizens.
Mm-hmm. And you also need to, as your book attests, couple that with knowledge.
Yeah, that's what I mean about listening. You know, you've got to listen before you act, and listen. And listening is often a skill too. So I hope that what I've also tried to do with this book is show that the betrayals, the failures, the setbacks, because that's all part of the journey as well. And in many ways, if you endeavor to start an organization or change something from within, as I'm now trying to do in my later career at Duke Energy, in order to do that, you really need to take a long view and build relationships that can really catalyze things.
I was also struck, you packed so much into this book, but I was struck by this trip that you took when I believe you were 14 to Africa, which really got the whole thing going. How you arrived, you remember what you were wearing, and you were just knocked out by the experience.
It was. I was 14 and in a very sort of self-interested place at the time. Had just finished junior high graduation, had a party, a bonfire party at my house, and a few friends and had smuggled in some liquor, and we got way too intoxicated, really betrayed my parents' trust at that point, and one of my friends even went into seizures at that point. And my parents had planned this trip to Africa. We didn't have a lot of means as a family, but this was the one international trip that they had planned for many years, and they actually debated whether or not to cancel it, but they decided to go through with it with the hopes that it'd really be a wake-up call for me. And it was. It was this extraordinary experience where we were only in Kenya for about 2 weeks, and I knew that I would be very taken by the animals and the wildlife and the beauty of the place, but I didn't know that I would form some initial bonds to the people there that were quite strong. And so that was my first exposure, and it was because of my parents, and it was a seed that I carried with me throughout college and then later with the Marines.
And was the other seed, I don't know if we're making too much of, or I would be making too much here, but the fact that you fell through an ice pond and almost died when you were very young, too, seems to be, it finds its place in the book and in promotional materials about you. Was that a big... Of course, it's a big thing.
It was another defining moment. I was a very young boy at the time, and I grew up in Rhode Island and was on the back of in my backyard on a pond with our golden retriever, and fell through the ice and was trapped for a half minute. It felt like a long time. For the first time in my life, I thought I might die as I was trying to find my way out of the pond in this frigid water. And when I came out of that, I really had this sense that when I got out of it, there was a spiritual moment for me where I had this sort of larger awareness that was kind of striking for me about my own mortality. And for whatever reason, from that point on, I started thinking that my life would be relatively short, and I started thinking that I would not survive past 30 years old.
Oh my!
And
you're 32 now, we might add. So
yeah, 32.
You have a long life ahead.
So I'm glad that the premonition didn't come through, but I really believed it. I mean, I believed it, and I led my life with a real sense of urgency, in part because of that.
Yeah, we have one comment on email I want to read to you. It's an important one, but you only have about 30 seconds to answer.
Okay.
My daughter is in Kenya in a semester program which focused on development. I'm leaving Saturday to visit her. I know she wants to show me Kibera, which she has visited. What's the respectful way to visit Kibera?
Such a great question.
Yeah, I thought
so. The community is getting tired of of sort of celebrity visits, which happen quite a bit now. Kivera has a larger degree of notoriety. I think the best way is to attach to an organization like ours, and would be delighted to be in touch with you about it. And when you visit, be prepared to make a contribution. You know, especially if the experience is valuable for you, be prepared to make a contribution, not directly to individuals. That can cause a lot of conflict, frankly, but to an organization that's really struggling and fighting to do the right thing on the ground. And I wish you a really good experience, and I hope that it would just be the first of a larger degree of exposure for you and your daughter to communities like Kibera.
Thank you, Rye. James Fellows was not off the mark. Thank you very much for being with us.
It's such a pleasure, Kathleen. Thank you.
Thanks. Rye Barcott, the book is It Happened on the Way to War, A Marine's Path to Peace. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for producing this hour, and thanks to Chrissy as well for on-air production in our downtown Milwaukee studios.